Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is March the 20th. We're on page 980, beginning Parshas Ekev. V'hoya Ekev Tishmeun, and it will be on account of the fact that you will listen to these laws, Ushmartem Bas Yisem Osam, you will guard and you will do them. Vishamar Hashem Elokecha Lecha Sabris Vesachesed, Hashem will guard for you the covenant and the kindness, Ashenish Bala Vosecha, that he swore to your ancestors. So the parsha begins with what appears to be a similar type of formula that we have in several places in the Chumash, where you begin with, if you do the right thing, then this is what will happen. And if Chas V'Shalom you do the wrong thing, then this is what will happen. That formula presents itself several places in the Chumash, and that is when it appears over here as well. If you keep the Torah properly, then the following is going to happen, a lot of good things that we're going to list, and then we should expect to see the negative. The thing is that the negative here does not present itself so quickly. The negative will present itself eventually, but only briefly, and it will not be for a little while. We won't get to it tonight. So this presentation is weighted in the positive. So if you will keep the Torah, then all of this is going to happen. Now, since it's weighted only in the positive, it must be that the Torah is emphasizing a certain type of performance of the Torah. Because if it's just to tell us that if you do the mitzvos, you will get rewarded, that message appears many times in the Torah and much more directly. This is going to be more specific about the good things that Hashem will do for you. And so Chazal tell us, Rashi quotes it here, that the word Ekev, which means on account of or because of, also means heel, as in Yaakov. Yaakov was holding on to the heel of Esav. That's why his name is named Yaakov. So it also means heel. And Chazal say, I'll read the Rashi to you, Ima mitzvos hakalos shadam dosh be'akavav tishmu'un. If you will listen to the mitzvos, then a person tramples with their heel the lighter, quote-unquote, lighter mitzvos, the kalos, the easier mitzvos, the ones that don't appear to be so significant. If you even keep those mitzvos, then all of the following will happen to you. And therefore, the discussion here is not simply about keeping the Torah. It is a discussion about being careful even with things that don't appear to be so significant. As many of the Mefarshim say, but I will quote Rabbeinu Yonah in Sharei Tshuva, as he writes, that a person who is interested in doing the service of Hashem, a person who is focused on Avodas Hashem, on serving Hashem, that person will not pay attention to the relative importance of a mitzvah versus a different mitzvah, but rather that person will focus on the importance of the one who commanded the mitzvos, which is Hashem. And if Hashem commanded the mitzvos, then they're all important. There's nothing unimportant or less important. It's all coming from Hashem. And there's no entity more important than Hashem. So whether it is something that appears to be more significant or something that appears to be less significant, a person who focuses on the fact that Hashem is the one commanding it will make sure to perform all of it. And that is what this parsha is referring to. That is, that if we keep even those mitzvahs that appear to be less important, then Hashem will guard for us the covenant and the kindness, and we will see the details that will now be presented. Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. V'ahevecha He will love you. Uveirachacha, he will bless you. Uveherbecha, he will increase you. Uveirach privitnacha ufiyad masecha, he will bless the fruit of your womb, which means children, and also the fruit of your land, that's produce. More specifically, degancha, your grain, v'siroshcha, your grapes, that's wine, v'yitzharecha, and your oil, that's olives. Shigara lafecha, v'ashteros tzonecha. So that is various animals that will be born. They translate that here as the offspring of your cattle, that will be Shigar Alafecha, and Ashteros Tzonecha will be the flocks of your sheep. Al Ha'adama Shenishbala Avosecha Laseslach. Not only that, this will all happen on the land that Hashem swore to give to your ancestors to give to you. So it will happen in Eretz Yisrael. As an aside, Chazal tell us that the sheep, the offspring of sheep, is called Ashteros Tzonecha. Ashteros, which means the offspring of sheep, also has the same root as osher, or wealth. Because sheep is a lucrative business. Sheep produce a lot and consume less than they produce. Because sheep not only produce offspring, of course. They multiply quickly. There's a lot of sheep that are born. But they also produce wool. So there is meat that one can get from sheep, but the wool is very lucrative. And so that's one of the reasons why the name for the offspring for sheep is Ashteros, Shem Ashteros Esbalan. They enrich their owners. Pasuk Yedal, verse 14. Baruch tiyeh mikol ha'amim, you will be blessed from all the nations. Lo yevecha akar va'akara uvivhemtecha. There will not be any male or female among you that is unable to have children, and also among your animals. Uvivhemtecha, also among your animals, that will be the case. So everybody will be able to be fruitful. Pasuk Tesvah, verse 15, Vehisir Hashem imcha kol choli, Hashem will remove from you all sickness, v'chol madvei Mitzrayim haraim asher yadata, and all of the maladies of Mitzrayim that were evil, that you knew, lo yisimam bach, he will not put them in you, he will not afflict you with them, unisanam b'chol son echa, and rather Hashem will afflict all of your enemies with those maladies. When Klal Yisrael saw all of the various makos, all of the plagues that were brought against the Egyptians, which we will be reading about at the Seder in very, very soon, just a few weeks, Klal Yisrael were very scared and thought that if Hashem brought them against the Egyptians, what would happen if, God forbid, we don't live up to what we're supposed to live up to? So it was scary to us. So here it's being used as a guarantee that if we do what we're supposed to do, then we will not be afflicted by those things. And rather, our enemies will be afflicted by them. You will consume all the enemies that Hashem, all the nations that Hashem is giving to you. Lo sachos eincha aleihem, do not have mercy upon them. V'lo savodes aloheihem, do not serve their gods. Kimokesh hulach, it is a stumbling block to you. So here we have our first warning that is embedded in these brachos. That yes, Hashem will do all this for us. However, we should not allow our mercy to become misplaced. It is possible for a person to have mercy in situations where they should not have mercy. And one of them is in the destruction of the nations that are in Eretz Yisrael when we come to Eretz Yisrael. We are commanded to kill them, and we are not allowed to have mercy upon them. That mitzvah does not apply to us, because that was a mitzvah that applied to them at that time. But you can see that that would be a very difficult mitzvah to keep, to maintain the conviction that the mitzvah is to kill them and not to allow ourselves to become merciful in that case, even though we are naturally a merciful people. Pasuk Yizayin, verse 17. Ki somar bilvavcha, when you will say in your heart, or lest you will say in your heart, Rabim haguim oyelem imani. These nations, they are much more than me. They're more than them than me. Eicha uchal lahorisham. How will I be able to conquer them? How is it possible? Lo sira mayhem, do not be afraid of them. Zachor tizkor es asher asa Hashem elokecha lefaro ulechol mitzrayim. You should remember what Hashem did to Paro and to all the Egyptians. Hamasos hagidolos asher ra'u einecha, the incredible miracles, or how are they going to translate that here? What's that?
Tests.
Tests, okay. That your eyes saw. Yeah. Vosos, vamofsim, the signs and the wonders. Vayana chazaka, the strong arm. Vazeroa, netuya, the outstretched arm. Asher utziacha, Hashem elokecha, that Hashem used to take you out. Kenya yaseh Hashem elokecha l'chol ha'amim, so Hashem will do to all the nations. Asher ata yorei mipnehem, that you are afraid of them. So now, Hashem has invoked Mitzrayim twice. Once is, if you do what you're supposed to do, Hashem will not afflict you with those things that he used to afflict the Egyptians. Rather, he will afflict your enemies with those things. Two, if rather than becoming afraid of your enemies, remember what Hashem did to the Egyptians. He will do the same thing to those who are opposing you in Eretz Yisrael. V'gamas ha-tzira yeshalach Hashem elokech abam, and also the tzira Hashem will send against them. They translate here the tzira is as the hornet swarm. Aravod anisharim anistarim mipanecha, until those who are remaining and those who are hiding will be destroyed from before you. Chazal tell us the tzira did two things to the enemy. Number one, it blinded them with its venom. And number two, it also caused them to be unable to have children. It made them sterile as well. That's what the tzira did with its venom against these people. Lo sarots mipneihem, do not be afraid of them. Ki Hashem elokecha bikirbecha, Hashem, your God is in your midst. Kael gadol vinora, a great and awesome God. Don't be a power, don't be afraid of these nations. When we sit around the Seder and we remember Yitzias Mitzrayim, we remember getting out of Egypt, and we say Chayav Adam Liros Es Atzmo Ki Luhu Yatzam Mitzrayim, that we are all obligated to see ourselves as if we left Mitzrayim. Our focus on Seder night, without question, is to highlight the fact that Hashem took us as His nation, that Hashem punished the Egyptians, took us out, made us free to serve Him, and His love for us. You see here that in addition to that, we are supposed to walk away from Egypt with other strong lessons, that Hashem wields incredible power that He will use against those who oppose Him. We don't want to be on that end of things. That's scary. And also, that we should not be afraid of our enemies, because Hashem will take care of them the same way He took care of the Egyptians. Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22. V'nashal Hashem elokecha hagoyim ho'el mipanecha me'at me'at. However, Hashem will remove these enemies of yours little by little. The English here is, will thrust these nations from before you. He'll push them out little by little. Lo suchal kalo sam maher, you will not be able to destroy them quickly. Pentir be'alecha chayas ha-sadeh, lest the beasts of the field increase against you. So, as we are conquering these nations, it may go more slowly than we expect. So here you have an example of something which we may look at and say, hey, this is not good. We're not conquering them as quickly as we expected. Hashem says, nope, that's not bad. That's actually good, because the nations of the because there's a lot of wild animals that would take over. If you remove the people, then the area becomes wild. And it becomes wild, and those wild animals become a danger. You may have gotten rid of the enemy people, but then it's no better if you populate that same area with wild animals. That is the natural order, that if you leave a place desolate, it becomes taken over by wild animals, snakes, scorpions, etc. And so the Hashem wants the population of people to not disappear, but rather be replaced by us. So it takes a little bit of time for us to increase and take over the areas that were populated by our enemies. Chav Gimel 23, Unisanam Hashem Elokecha lefanecha, Hashem, your God will put them before you. V'hamam mehuma gedola, He will confuse them greatly. Adi shamadam, until they are destroyed. V'nasan malchehem biyadecha, He will put their kings in your hands. V'havaratayes shemam mitachas ha-shamayim, and He will destroy their names, or you will destroy their names from underneath the heavens. Lo yisyatzev ish befanecha, no man will stand before you, adi shmidcha osam, until you destroy them. Pisile Eloheihem tisrefun ba'esh, their graven gods, carved images of gods, you will burn in fire. Lo sachmod kesef v'zahav aleihem, do not desire the silver and gold that is on them. V'lakachta lach, and take it for yourself. Pen tivakesh bo, lest you stumble with it. Ki so'avas Hashem elokecha hu, for this is the abomination of Hashem your God, these idols. V'lo saviso evayo beisecha, do not bring an abomination to your home. V'ayisa cherem kamohu, and then you will become, it says in English, band like it. Rather, shaketz teshaksenu v'sa'ev tesavenu. You should, these are various words that mean to abhor or hate these things. Loathe and abhor it. Ki cherem hu, for it is banned. Referring to Avodah Zarah. I'm going to pause here with a little bit of a discussion about Avodah Zarah, about idols, idolatry, what becomes prohibited, and what is permitted. Chazal tell us that we know that that which is worshipped by the non-Jews as an Avodah Zarah, as an idolatry, becomes prohibited. That which is offered also becomes prohibited. Now, they will often worship things that are considered to be either attached to the ground or part of the heavens. They'll worship the sun, the moon, mountains, rivers, waterfalls, etc. Those things do not become prohibited. It's only an item that is on those things that could become prohibited. If there's an idol that is there, it could become prohibited. An offering can become prohibited. If something which is offered, which there are parameters for that, not everything that is offered becomes prohibited, but sometimes things can become prohibited if they are offered to an Avodah Zarah. Similarly, that which is used to adorn an Avodah Zarah can become prohibited. So if there is gold or silver, like it's being mentioned over here, that is used to adorn the Avodah Zarah, then it too becomes prohibited. However, Chazal point out that in Pasuk Chav Hei 25, the Pasuk says, Lo sachmod kesef v'zahav aleihem, do not desire the gold and silver that is upon them, v'lakach talach, and take it for yourself. The simple reading is, don't desire it and take it, because it's prohibited. But one could also read it as, don't desire it, comma, take it for yourself. Which means you could take it for yourself. So which one is it? Are you not supposed to desire it and take it? or are you allowed to take it for yourself? So Chazal explained there is a concept of bittul. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Shehakol Nehiyah Baro. A non-Jew is able to be mevatel avodah zarah. A non-Jew is able to nullify idolatry. That means that if there is something that the non-Jew worships, let's say there's an idol that the non-Jew worships, and then the non-Jew is mevatel it, he nullifies it, he says, this thing is no longer my God, then it removes it from the category of avodah zarah. And then we are allowed to benefit from it. So the Gemara discusses various cases for what would be considered nullifying it. So for example, what is the law if the non-Jew, there's this avodah zarah, and the non-Jew breaks it? Well, by breaking it, he's showing that this is no longer his what he worships. He's decided it's not a god anymore. That is nullifying it. What about if he would sell it? If he would sell it to a Jew, sell it to a non-Jew, what would the law be there? Well, if he sells it to a non-Jew, certainly it would seem that he's not nullifying it because he's well aware that his fellow non-Jew might worship it. What if he sells it to a Jew? Is he saying that clearly it's not a god because the Jews aren't going to worship it? Or is he assuming that the Jew will simply be a middleman and resell it to another non-Jew who will serve it? So this is a debate in the Gemara. Either way, we see there is a concept of bittul, that a non-Jew could be mevatel avodah zarah, could nullify it. A Jew cannot nullify avodah zarah. Only a non-Jew can nullify avodah zarah. When David HaMelech was when he was conquering all the nations around him, the last nation that was conquered was Ammon, and they had a very, very expensive, very beautiful crown that was used for their avodah zarah, which became the crown of David HaMelech. The Gemara asks, how could David HaMelech use a crown that was part of an avodah zarah? The Gemara says that before the Jews took possession of it, Itai Hagiti, who was a friend of David HaMelech, who was a non-Jew, he was mevatel the avodah zarah. He nullified it. And then David was able to wear it. Is that nullified the avodah zarah? But a Jew cannot nullify avodah zarah. Only a non-Jew can, and it has to be an avodah zarah that is a non-Jew's avodah zarah. If a Jew makes something into an avodah zarah, then it cannot be nullified. So this rule of nullification is very, very important. There was a number of years ago, there was a whole issue that arose with sheitels, with wigs that came from India, and a whole discussion of whether those wigs might be prohibited because of avodah zarah. This touched off an entire discussion in an area that we're not so familiar with because we do not live amongst non-Jews who practice idolatry in that way. The issue with Christianity is not an issue of idolatry per se. It's an issue of it's an issue of shituf, which means believing in more than one God, which gets into the exact theology of Christianity, which is clearly beyond the scope of tonight's shiur. However, certainly we don't have here in the United States, we don't commonly have the types of practice that you have in the Far East. And in the Far East, where there is more attention given to different types of gods and different types of worship and different types of offerings, Avodah Zarah can still be something which presents itself more frequently. So I am certainly no expert in what their practice there is or was, and I do not know all the details of the discussion, but I do know, at least as a basic presentation, that there is or was some sort of a practice in which women would go or do go to their places of worship, and as part of a ritual, have their hair shorn. And then that hair is made into wigs, and it is sold. So the question becomes, what is the nature of that practice? What's the nature of that ritual? If, I'm not saying that this is what it is, I'm saying that if this is what it would be, if it would be an offering, if the hair is being offered, and then that is being made into a wig, and then that wig is sold, then it might be an offering to an avodah zarah, which means it would be prohibited. And the sale of the hair in the form of a wig is not necessarily bittul. It's not necessarily nullifying it as something that was offered to an avodah zarah, which would make it prohibited to derive any benefit from. That would be one possibility. There are many other possibilities that would render it no problem. For example, let's say it was not given as an offering, but rather let's say it was being used to help the priests with earn a living, something along those lines. Something like that would be different than an offering to Avodah Zarah. So, or perhaps it wasn't an offering. Perhaps it's just a ritual, but it's not an offering. This led to some investigation into what exactly is being done over there. And today, whatever the issue was has largely been cleared up. Whether the practice changed, whether the purchasing system of the people who sell wigs has changed, or whether there really was no problem in the first place, I can't tell you. I don't know all the details. But it revolves around this discussion of what becomes prohibited when involved in an avodah zarah, and how, if possible, if it's possible, and if it is possible, how to nullify that avodah zarah. So So this was, as I said, a number of years ago, this became a very, very big topic. It seems to have somehow worked itself out by now. But the point to be aware of here is that a Jew cannot nullify Avodah Zarah. So if it really was a problem, and now it's in the hands of a Jew, there's nothing that can be done about it other than to destroy it. It cannot be nullified anymore. Can't derive any benefit from it, so you can't sell it back. The only thing you can do is destroy it. So so it was an issue at that time, and again, I think that it has largely worked itself out by now. I don't know how it worked itself out, but it seems that it has.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Why would it, I mean, women have been wearing shadels for a lot of years. Why now was it started? I mean, I was involved in that also. But, you know, what happened that was so different that, you know, it became such a big thing? And you know, people lost from Parnassa, the shadel places. I mean, it was a disaster.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what happened. But first of all, it's the hair might have started to come from those areas, and rather than other areas, that probably changes over time, where the hair is primarily coming from, number one. Number two, it could be somebody just discovered it, that it was a problem, and nobody realized it until then. It's also possible. I don't know. But we're going back now, you know, a couple of decades. So as I said, I think that they have by now worked that through. But this is what it revolves around, this issue of what exactly is prohibited, and then can it be nullified or not? Yeah.
Rabbi Pransky, the chus of the women in Klai Yisrael
There were bonfires. They went and they burned the shaitels in bonfires.
Yes, some people did burn the shaitels, those that the ruling was needed to be burned. A lot of them did not need to be burned, but the ones that needed to be, yes, there some women did give up it was a lot of money, and they were willing to do that because of the prohibition. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So the Egyptians worshipping the sun and moon, that's not Avodah Zarah?
Right. So the question is, the Egyptians worshipping the sun and moon, that is Avodah Zarah, but it does not prohibit them. Anything that is either attached to the ground or a planet or a star or something that does not become usur. Does not become prohibited. We'll learn later. We'll have a pasuk later on that will teach that to us. That those things do not become prohibited. The Mishnah says in Maseches Avodah Zarah that there was a philosopher that asked one of the Tanaim, one of the sages of the Mishnah, if Hashem does not allow Avodah Zarah, why doesn't he just destroy all of the Avodah Zarah? So the Tana said back, because they worship things that the world needs to survive. The sun, the moon, water, mountains, valleys, etc. Yovad ha'olam mipnei hashotim. The world should be destroyed because of the fools? Hashem's not going to destroy his world just because people worship things that are necessary for the world. So the philosopher asked, okay, fine. So then let Hashem leave those things intact, but let him destroy the non-essential things that are worshipped. So if they worship a particular statue, let Hashem destroy that statue. If he's not going to destroy the sun and the moon, but let him destroy that which they worship, which is non-essential. So the Tana responded, if Hashem would do that, that would only serve to make it appear that the worship of the sun and the moon is actually valid. Because only the statues are being destroyed, but the sun and the moon are not being destroyed. So that would be a proof, so to speak, to those who worship the sun and the moon, that their worship must be valid. So therefore, since Hashem is not going to destroy the sun and the moon, he does not destroy the other things as well, the statues, etc., that are worshipped. And Hashem leaves them. And as we know, the rule is that this world is available to people and we are expected to use it properly. And if people misuse it, that is personal choice, and people are going to be punished or rewarded for how they make their choices. But Hashem does not just destroy everything because of personal choice. He did destroy once. That was the Mabul. That was the great flood. That's because everybody did that. But in a typical world where there are those who are evil and those who are righteous, Hashem doesn't just destroy everything because people make poor choices. Yeah?
Didn't we have to cut down trees in the land?
Okay, the question is, didn't we have to cut down trees in the land? The answer is yes. That's going to be the one exception. We'll see this later on, that an Asherah, a tree that is worshipped, does become prohibited and needs to be cut down. So that we will get to later on. That is going to be the one case that's the exception. But it has to be spelled out, because the default is that if it's attached to the ground or it's part of the heavens, then it would not become prohibited. That's the default. Right. That is a good point. Perek Ches, chapter 8, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Kol ha-mitzvah shanochi mitzavcha hayom tishmeru la'asos. All the mitzvos that I am commanding you today, you should guard to do. Leman tichyun, so that you will live. Urevisem, you will increase. Uvasem, virishtem es haaretz, you will come and you will conquer the land. Asher nishba Hashem la'avosechem, that Hashem swore to your ancestors. The phrase kol ha-mitzvah, which we translated as all the mitzvos, it actually says it in the singular. All the mitzvah. The intention here is all the mitzvos. All the, sometimes you have the plural written in the singular. However, there is a drasha, which is kol ha-mitzvah, the entire mitzvah, which means do the entire mitzvah. Don't do a mitzvah partially. do the entire thing, because the credit for the mitzvah goes to the one who finishes it. Meaning, of course, everybody who contributes to doing a mitzvah is rewarded for contributing to do a mitzvah. However, the one who completes it gets an extra measure of reward. The completing of the mitzvah is the main part of the mitzvah. And as proof to this, Rashi tells us that we know who is responsible for getting Yosef's bones out of Egypt. So we know that in Parashas Beshalach it says, Vayikach Moshe es atzmos Yosef imo. Moshe took the bones of Yosef with him. So that was something great that he did. However, later it says in Sefer Yehoshua, the book of Yehoshua, it says that the Jews are the ones who got the credit for transferring Yosef's bones from Egypt and burying him in Eretz Yisrael. Why are the Jews singled out and not Moshe Rabbeinu, even though he's the one who made sure to take Moshe's bones with him? Because Moshe could not finish the mitzvah, because he didn't go into Eretz Yisrael. So because of that, even though of course he gets a certain measure of credit for it, but the main credit goes to the one who completes the mitzvah. Therefore, kol ha-mitzvah, the entire mitzvah. Make sure to finish the job. If you start a mitzvah, finish off the mitzvah. It's your mitzvah. Don't give it up. Don't let it go. Complete the mitzvah. Pasuk Beis, verse 2. V'zachartos kol ha-derech, you should remember all of the road, asher holichecha, Hashem elokecha, ze'ar ba'im shana ba'midbar, that Hashem, your God, led you these 40 years through the wilderness, lemana noscha, in order to afflict you, linasoscha, to test you, ladas es asher bilvavcha, to know what is in your heart, hasishmar mitzvosav imlo, will you guard his mitzvos or not? The trek through the wilderness was difficult. Parts of it we were miraculously cared for, but parts of it were actually rather difficult. And we know that the Jews did stumble several times and complained and demanded to go back to Egypt. And now we are seeing that the reason for those were tests to see how the Jews would do. Sometimes we did well, sometimes we did not. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, Vayyancha, and he afflicted you, Vayarivecha, and he made you hungry, Vayachilcha es hamana shelo yadata, and he fed you the man that you did not know, V'lo yod'un avosecha, and your ancestors did not know, Lamano diacha, in order to let you know, Ki lo al alechem levado yichye ha'adam. Here we have a very, very famous quote, for not on bread alone does man survive, for in all that is brought about by the mouth of Hashem, a person will survive. Not only through bread, but the way that Hashem decides, that is how man will survive. Man was the prime example of that. There was no regular bread, and we survived because of the man that came from heaven. The man we know was miraculous. We know that there was enough man per person every day for the people to survive. We know the man tasted the way you wanted it to taste. We know there was no effort in growing it or preparing it. It was just, you got it and you ate it and it did what it behaved as it should behave. However, here we find that the man is characterized as something which was a form of affliction and, for lack of a better term, starvation. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3 begins, and Hashem afflicted you and he starved you and he fed you the man. Now the simple reading would be that before the man fell, there was nothing to eat. We were afflicted. We were starved. We complained. There's nothing to eat. And Hashem responded by giving us the man. However, the Mefarshim, the commentaries explain that the eating of the man was a form of affliction and a form of starvation. Meaning, not chas v'shalom that we starved, the man was perfect, it was excellent. However, you were not allowed to leave any man over. You had to completely consume all the man that you got for that day. Anything that was left would spoil and become wormy, and was inedible after that day. The we are very unused to that kind of practice, to consume every morsel of food that one has every day. There is no more food. To go to sleep at night and the cupboard is bare, and to wake up in the morning knowing that if the mun does not fall, then there will be nothing to eat. That's something which we have never experienced. We actually are the furthest from that practice, probably, than any society in the history of the world, at least since the Mabul. It's hard to know what it was like before the Mabul. But since then, we may be the society that is furthest from it. Because not only do we have relative affluence, meaning, of course, there are poor people, but relatively speaking, their food is plentiful, and people have access to it. But in addition to that, food today can be preserved for much longer than it used to be. Used to be, milk was regularly turned into cheese because it was the only way to preserve it without refrigeration. And the cheese that it was turned into was aged cheese, the type that does not need refrigeration. You keep it on the counter. Because they didn't have refrigeration. They didn't have freezing. And therefore, the only way to preserve milk was through making it into cheese. The only way to preserve meat was to cure it. And that, therefore, it was cured. That's what they did. Salt was very, very important to cure the meat in order to preserve it, to cure the fish in order to preserve it. It was the only way. Otherwise, there was no such thing as preserving. There were no preservatives other than salt. Salt was the only preservative. And there was certainly no freezing and no refrigeration. So the ability to keep food for very, very long periods of time, as we do, did not exist in regular, at least not all types of foods. You could pickle things. They did that. They pickled fruits and vegetables. You could do that. That was a way of doing it. Again, it was using salt to preserve these items. But today we have, first of all kinds of ways of keeping things preserved for very long periods of time. Number one. Number two, there is so much. The stores, Baruch Hashem, are full. And we can always go to the store and buy. And a typical person has in their house a great deal of food, and a person can go to the store and buy more. And so we do not live day to day. We don't use up all the food and then the next day need to go out and buy food. I think the closest anybody comes to this is the night that Pesach is over. Right? When you run out to restock your pantry. Or even then, it's not that we have nothing in the house. We typically have leftovers from Pesach, even though no one wants to eat it anymore. But there is food. In theory, if there wasn't any chametz to get their hands on, they would eat the Pesach stuff. You know, that's what we would do. So, but the concept of going to bed at night, having consumed every last crumb, and there is nothing left, and then expecting the mun to be there in the morning, there's anxiety with that. And that is something which is a difficult way to live. And it is relying 100% on Hashem. That Hashem will have the mun fall tomorrow, the way he had it fall today. I will get my portion the way I got it today. I'll get it tomorrow, and it'll be available. And I won't have a problem with not having what to eat, with my family not having what to eat. And that can be a frightening thing. So that is Vayyancha Vayarivecha. He afflicted you and he starved you and he fed you the mun. To let you know that one does not only live on bread, but on whatever Hashem provides, that is what we live on. This phrase that, Al Halechem Yichya Ha'adam, really it says that a person does not only live on bread, but you do see from here that bread is the staple. That's the main thing. In other words, mun is replacing bread, but bread is the main thing. So this is why we have specific laws when it comes to bread made by a non-Jew. The rule is that pas, that bread, akum, that is made by a non-Jew, the default would be that we're not allowed to consume that bread. It is not a Torah law, this is a rabbinic prohibition, and that applies in many cases. Now we'll talk about where it applies in a moment, but what's the reason for this gezerah, for this decree? Because al halechem yichya ha'adam, people live on bread, bread is the staple, and therefore when Chazal were making decrees to ensure separation between Jews and non-Jews, which was primarily to avoid intermarriage, so one of the main foods they, so to speak, went after was bread, because bread is the staple. And if you can't eat their bread, then that will create an inherent separation between Jew and non-Jew. So you have a neighbor who is a non-Jew, and they invite you for a meal which is completely kosher, but you can't eat their bread, that is going to create a separation. And that was the intent of this decree. Now, where does that apply? Again, it's rabbinic. It is not from the Torah, it's rabbinic in nature. But where does it apply? So it certainly applies to pas akum, which means bread baked by a non-Jew, which means the simple case would be the case that I just presented, that a non-Jew bakes bread in their home, then that would be a case where it would apply that we would not be allowed to eat that bread. There, the question becomes, what about pas palter? What about the bread baked by a baker? Not in their home, but rather baked commercially in a baker's oven by a baker to sell. Does the prohibition of pas akum apply? Or I should say, does the requirement of what we would call pas Yisrael apply in that case? So there are various discussions among the poskim, and normative practice is that pas palter, bread baked by a baker who is not Jewish, is permitted, and that is why you can find kosher bread on the market that is produced by companies owned by non-Jews. Because pas palter, because bread produced by a non-Jew as a baker is permitted. There is an extra stringency which many people keep, which is to only eat pas Yisrael, to only eat that the bread that is produced by a Jew and not by a non-Jew. But the baseline, the default rule, is that pas palter, bread produced by a non-Jewish baker, is permitted. Everybody agrees that pas akum, that bread produced by a non-Jew in a non-commercial setting, is prohibited. That is undisputed. So when that's why the way that the stringency, the way the chumrah is expressed is, does one keep pas Yisrael or not? No one says, do we keep pas akum or not? Of course we keep pas akum. Everybody keeps pas akum. No one is allowed to consume bread that is produced by a non-Jew that is in their own home without commercial purposes. The case of stringency and leniency is the case of pas palter is produced by commercially by a baker. That's where there are leniencies to consume it, and then there are those who are strict and do not consume it. There's also an in-between stringency, which is not to consume it if there is pas Yisrael available. That is also a valid level of stringency, that if to only consume pas palter, to only consume the bread produced commercially by a non-Jew, in the event that there is no similar bread being produced by a Jew. That is, but if there would be bread, similar bread produced by a Jew, then one would only have Pas Yisrael. That is also a stringency that we find. So, whatever your level of stringency is, rest assured, you also keep Pas Akum. Everybody does. No kashrus agency would give certification to bread that is produced non-commercially. If your next door neighbor bakes bread, who is not Jewish, you would not be allowed to eat that bread, even if all the ingredients are kosher, even if they kasher their oven in advance, it would not make a difference. That would be the clear-cut gezerah, the decree of Pas Akum. And the leniency is Pas Palter, is bread that is produced by a baker in a commercial setting.
What if you turned on his stove?
So what if you turned on his stove? So there is a discussion whether that would transform it from being Pas Akum to being Pas Yisrael. Does that make it into Jewish produced bread? And again, normative practice is that we are lenient with that. Some are stringent, but we are typically lenient with that if we turn on the stove, then that would mitigate it. That's correct. Yeah. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Simlas chalovah same alecha, your clothing did not wear out from upon you. Viragla chalovah tseka, and your feet did not swell, meaning from the walking. Zer ba'im shana, these 40 years. The word batseka, which means swell, comes from the word batsek. Batsek means dough, as in rising, dough that rises. So when the skin swells because of infection or whatever it is, that's a similar word. So the clothing did not wear out because the anane kavod, the clouds of glory, brushed against the clothing and made the clothing fresh. The clothing was made fresh. It did not need laundering. It did not need to be replaced. It grew with the people, the clothing. There was a special miracle that went on with the clothing as well. So this is emphasizing the miracles that Hashem did for us besides the man, that our clothing also was protected. Now, that's not coincidental that it was the clouds of glory that did that, because of the three things that we need in order to survive, we need food, we need water, and we need shelter. Clothing is a form of shelter. The clouds provided the shelter. Therefore, the clouds are the ones that made the clothing, is the item that Hashem used to make the clothing viable. The man was for the bread, and of course the water of the well was for water. Those are the three essentials of survival. Okay, I think that I'm just debating whether to stop here or to go one more pasuk. I think that we'll stop here at pasuk 8, verse 5. I think that's what we'll stop for tonight. And Mirz Hashem will continue next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.